Ali Habib with our American stories, and it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, all the things that matter in life. Check out hillsdale.edu to learn more about what's going on there. And if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale will get to you with their great online courses. And today we're celebrating the life of President Abraham Lincoln, who was assassinated on this day in history in the year 1865. Here to join us to celebrate his life and discuss his leadership qualities is what we think is hands down, the best leadership writer in the country on all sorts of leadership, from sports to politics to religion, you name the space. Pat Williams writes about it. He's written over 80 books on leadership. He's the co-founder of the Orlando Magic. And, well, one of the books on leadership was Lincoln Speaks to Leaders and 21 Great Leaders, which has a chapter on Lincoln, both of which you'll want to pick up after this interview. Pat, thanks so much for joining us.
Lee, thanks a million. Good to talk to you.
Now, Pat, of the range of the things we've talked about, from John Wooden to Martin Luther King, where does Lincoln line up? Because for me, Lincoln lines up like number one with George Washington, co-equal space. Where does he line up for you?
I don't think there's any question when you look at the leaders in American history, you've got to put Lincoln at the top of the list. You know, I would have him ranked number one. Washington would be the second on that list. It is interesting, isn't it, in the two most pivotal times in American history, the start of our nation and then the potential breakup of our nation, that we had two leaders of that magnitude in the White House. I shudder to think if two other men, not as strong, not as capable, were there, what might have happened to our nation. But I think in any polling of the top leaders in American history in any field, I'm going to put Lincoln at the number one slot.
And by the way, Pat, if you remember when we were discussing John Wooden, he had two pictures of people he adored, and one was Mother Teresa, and of course the other was Abraham Lincoln. Before we dig in, Pat, do you think great times or hard times make for great leaders, or can hard times just as easily make for terrible leaders?
Well, the leaders that we most remember that are high on our list are those that went through the toughest times. Washington, of course, you know, getting a whole new nation launched. Lincoln, when the world just seemed to go crazy and the Civil War took place, Lincoln was right in the middle of that. Roosevelt, the Great Depression, followed by World War II. Martin Luther King in the 60s, the civil rights marches. I think that those very, very difficult times really pull the very best out of leaders. That would be my view.
Yeah, I think so, too. And, you know, my dad's a student of history. He also thinks that periodically, you take a look at Germany in the 1930s, and you had a demagogue exploit hard times to seize power. And I think we've been graced in this country, and I think, you know, maybe some people might even ascribe it to divine intervention, that during our toughest times, some of our greatest men have arisen. You have any thoughts on that, Pat?
Oh, I think there's truth to it, Lee. I think that I think God has his hand on our country, always has. And at the times of the greatest needs, we have had strong leaders step up and serve in the White House or wherever, and we should be very, very grateful for that.
Let's talk.
Lincoln remains fascinating to people. John Wooden would be a good example. When you walked into his apartment or his condo in Encino, California, down the hall and then straight ahead, there was a table, and on the right there was a tribute to Mother Teresa, and on the left a tribute to Abraham Lincoln. Those were his two heroes. He had a third hero, and he would tell you it was Billy Graham. That was, by the way, that was the third hero of his life. But Lincoln was a hero and a role model to many leaders. Certainly every president who's been in the White House, you know, has hopefully done a thorough study of Lincoln.
Let's talk about Lincoln's servant heart, if we can. You just mentioned the word serve. And let's start at the beginning and talk about his humility as a child, and especially his humility about his own education. Talk about this early part of his life and how it informed the latter part of his life, Pat.
Well, he grew up under very, very meager circumstances. His mother, who he was close to, died of a milkweed disease. His father, he was not close to. His father and he had a very difficult relationship. Thomas Lincoln found a woman who he married, and she became really the mother to Lincoln. He was very, very close to Sarah Bush Lincoln, loved her, and she saw something in Lincoln that was special. He didn't have a formal education, Lee, but he had a great, great desire to read, and he constantly was finding books and immersed himself in the books, which always frustrated his father because his father wanted him out there working nonstop. You know, out in the fields or around the house, he wanted him working. And Lincoln, whenever he could, would find a moment, you know, and immerse himself in books. So that was his early background, and I think he was always self-conscious that he didn't have a formal education, didn't have an education in depth. He did it all on his own, which, by the way, Lee, is a good lesson for all of us, the importance of reading and the importance after your formal education is finished, your education really is beginning.
Yep.
By really stepping up and studying on your own.
Well, that's so true, Pat. And when we come back, we're going to start to dig into young Abraham Lincoln's life. By the way, if we remember, when we were talking about the Wright brothers here in Our American Stories, David McCulloch told us it was the same thing about that genius Wilbur. There wasn't a book the guy hadn't read. Totally self-taught. Totally self-taught. This is Lee Habib.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More with Pat Williams, the life of Abraham Lincoln, leadership. More after these messages. Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, Abraham Lincoln's life, today with Pat Williams, who we talk to regularly about leadership, and we're looking at Lincoln's leadership and his life in this segment, celebrating Abraham Lincoln's life on the day of his death, of all things. Pat, I wanted to play you a clip for you from the History Channel's documentary titled Lincoln, The Untold Stories, and it's about his education. Let's take a listen.
Lincoln's passion for study was fueled by his disdain for his father, who could barely sign his own name.
Lincoln's father served as something of a negative model for him. He regarded his father as lacking ambition, as lazy, as anti-intellectual. All the things that Lincoln wanted to escape from, he saw in his father.
Was he too tough on his dad, or these guys maybe have it a little off, Pat?
Oh, I think it's right on. From what I've read from my study of Lincoln, this relationship with his father was not good. As I said earlier, Thomas Lincoln wanted his boy, you know, out there working nonstop, and I'm sure Lincoln did his share of work. You know, because in those days, you know, you had to do it within your family. But he cherished those moments when he could be alone.
Right.
Under a tree or next to a candlelight. He was hungry to learn.
Yeah.
Self-educated. Sure paid off, didn't it?
You think? I want to play another clip, Pat, from the History Channel documentary about Lincoln's first real opportunity to serve as a leader.
In 1832, when Indians under Chief Blackhawk tried to reclaim tribal homelands by force. Adventurous young men, including Lincoln, rushed to volunteer. The militiamen elected their own officers, and Lincoln's company overwhelmingly chose him as their captain. He would later say this gave him more pleasure than any other success.
To have the esteem of his fellow soldiers, militiamen, was an enormous ego boost for this fellow who feels a little uncertain about his identity and a little ashamed of his background. And so I think that gave him a taste of being elected. He didn't run for it. They just chose him. And then he thought, well, this is fun.
Yeah, I mean, you do have to get elected to be captain. You can't be captain without people putting you up there in sports. And this goes for the military, too. Talk, Pat, about this first leadership experience. What did he learn from it? And was there a memorable or aha moment for him during this time?
Oh, he used to kid about it later on, you know, that was the extent of his military involvement. He said I think his most memorable moment was getting bitten by mosquitoes. But he kind of kidded about that experience, you know, as a military guy. And that was the end of it. You know, he never got back involved or got bitten by the military bug.
Right.
He wanted to be a lawyer. I mean, that's really what had gotten him excited. And he was determined, you know, through self-education to become a lawyer and practice law. And that's what he did as a young adult. He finally got stamped to be a lawyer. He went out and did his job as a lawyer and gained all sorts of experience. And, of course, that opened the door into the world of politics.
And let's talk about Lincoln's servant's heart as a young lawyer, because you're just talking about as a lawyer. In Springfield, Illinois, the time in his life that earned him the nickname Honest Abe from his fellow leaders. Can you share the great story in your book, 21 Great Leaders, Pat, about his partner, Ward Lehman, and a Mr. Scott?
Well, here's what I can tell you about that period, Lee. We see through those legal experiences Lincoln's kindness, Lincoln's desire to help people, Lincoln's desire to really be served in a serving role. I mean, and time after time after time after time, we read that, we hear that. And then when he got to the White House, you might think he would change the way he went about business, but not at all. And in the White House, over and over and over and over again, during the Civil War, we read and hear about Lincoln continuing to serve. I think when you study leadership, those leaders we most remember, I like to point out they lead with a serving heart. And they never change from that. And I think that's why we admire them so much, those kinds of leaders.
I think that's right, Pat. And, you know, the other thing that's overlooked is what a great attorney Lincoln was. I had the good fortune to read a book called Lincoln's Greatest Case last year, and it was all about his representation of the railroads in the great steamboat case. And this is an epic battle. And there was an interesting scene where people looked at this bumpkin lawyer and wondered. I mean, the folks were wondering, can this guy possibly do all the engineering? Can he manage the current studies? Can he manage just the sheer power of the arguments that are coming at him from the then entrenched steamboat industry and the little nascent railroad industry fighting? And my goodness, boy, did Lincoln, though humble and always sort of aw-shucking it, did he tear them up, Pat? What a competitor.
Yeah, you listen, Lee, you express that beautifully, far better than I could. So let's just say an amen to that book and to the impact it had on your life and your view of Lincoln. He was a marvelous lawyer. And Lee, you know, if he'd stayed with it instead of going into politics, well, he would have been a memorable leader or a memorable lawyer of all time. But I'm glad he was a man of ambition. There's no denying that. And he had a hunger, you know, to get to Washington and become a president of the United States. And he competed, And he battled, you know, and he wanted that post, and he got it.
Yep, and thank.
And then he had to go through it again, you know, to get reelected.
That's
so,
right.
He was a there was a toughness to him as well as that serving side. There was a boldness to Lincoln that balanced out that serving heart.
I want to play a clip here, Pat, from the History Channel documentary that we've been talking about because it was so good, about Lincoln's first real experience with slaves.
It was in Washington that Lincoln had his first in-depth encounter with slavery. He could not walk from his boarding house to the Capitol without seeing the slave auction houses, Negro livery stables, he called them.
Think of having a slave auction across from the Capitol. That's what occurred. You know, people look out, our foreign visitors look out and they see men and women being sold like cattle. For Lincoln, I think it was especially an event because I think Lincoln believed firmly in the principles of this country and equality and liberty.
Talk about how those experiences moved him to be the man and leader he was, Pat.
Well, there's no question that experience in Washington was vital. And then, Lee, there were other examples when he took a boat down the Mississippi River and ended up in New Orleans and saw the same thing going on there. And I think that left a deep, deep imprint on the man. Really shook him up. And he was determined when he got into the White House, when the timing was right, to free those people, free the slaves. And he did. And then you talk about courage and boldness. It took a ton of that for Lincoln to do that, but he felt very, very strongly that that was one of the missions that he had while he was here on this earth.
Well, you know, in your book, Pat, you so correctly point out that Lincoln was so incensed by the repeal of the Missouri Compromise that he came out of political retirement and decided to seek political office all over again, and he joined the Republican Party because it was founded specifically to oppose slavery. You did also add that a year after the Dred Scott decision, he delivered his House Divided speech, inspired, of course, by Mark 35, Pat. And if a house be divided against itself, that house cannot stand. We're going to have one more segment with Pat Williams. We're talking about leadership. We're talking about the life of Abraham Lincoln. We'll do another hour with Dr. Larry Arnn on the statesmanship of Lincoln. And statesmanship and leadership are different things. They're tied together, but they are somewhat different. More after these messages with Pat Williams. Again, the life of Abraham Lincoln celebrated on this day, the day he was assassinated at Ford's Theater. And this is Our American Stories. Today we're celebrating the life of President Abraham Lincoln, who was assassinated on this day in history in the year 1865. And joining us, as always, to talk about leadership, and this runs the gamut from sports to religion and politics, is Pat Williams. He's the co-founder of the Orlando Magic and also the author of over 80 books on leadership, including Lincoln Speaks to Leaders and 21 Great Leaders, which has a chapter on Lincoln. And I wanted to dig into the war itself, Pat, because here's the President of the United States, and he's a leader, but he's got to find his generals to now prosecute this war. In other words, he's got to find the right leaders to inspire the men to fulfill the goal and the mission of the Union Army. Talk first about his relationship with General McClellan.
Well, I think the most frustrating part of the whole war was Lincoln's trying to find that right, those right generals, you know, to lead. And you'll recall early in the war, the Confederacy was prevailing, and they were winning some pretty significant battles. And Robert E. Lee was in the middle of it, and Stonewall Jackson, and they had, you know, a very strong core of leaders. The Union did not. And Lincoln was forced to keep changing leaders constantly. His relationship with McClellan is fascinating. McClellan was a short little guy. They called him Little Napoleon or Little Mac. He was very good at discipline. He was very good at planning and organization. But when it was time to really dig in and do battle, McClellan was very, very slow and very, very deliberate. And all that frustrated Lincoln. There were so many opportunities he felt when McClellan could win the war. And McClellan always had an excuse. Too many soldiers on the other side. I don't have enough forces. I don't have enough this. I don't have enough that. And that's when Lincoln promoted Grant to take over the whole Union Army. And Lincoln was thrilled that Grant didn't ask him for anything. Never asked for more troops or more weapons or more this, that, or the other. He just went about his business in a very dogged fashion with what he had and won the war. And Lincoln finally found that general, put full trust and faith in him, and Grant came through for him. So I think that's one of the most fascinating studies in the entire Civil War, that relationship with Lincoln and his generals, and particularly his relationship with General Grant toward in the last year of the war.
And I would think, Pat, just as in any organization, you're the CEO, and you've got some senior vice presidents who are very talented, and you may not see eye to eye with him, you may not like the style of that man or woman, but they're getting the job done. And what do we learn from this as leaders about how to deal with folks who are different than us, but folks who just get out there and do the thing? What advice do we, what can we glean from this? Why did it take Lincoln too long to rip through his leaders? Did he stick with McClellan too long? What do we glean from all that?
Well, he hired McClellan in the first place, then dismissed him, then brought him back, you know, right before the Battle of Antietam in September of 1862, and because he had nobody else to turn to. He didn't really want to turn that whole thing over to McClellan. He was frustrated by McClellan, but he felt there was nobody else he could turn to. So I guess the bottom line to all of this, when you think about it, is give people a chance. If they are not producing, you've got to move them on and get somebody else in there. And from the time the war started, over and over and over, Lincoln was having to change generals. He had to do it half a dozen times. And, you know, it was frustrating to him. But I guess the bottom line was we didn't have a whole wealth of generals sitting there ready to take over and deal with this most unique war.
You know, I want to play another clip for you, Pat, where Lincoln's running of the actual White House was quite humble, too. Here is the final clip we're going to play for you from that History Channel documentary.
And while Mary's White House was extravagant, Abraham's was simplicity itself. He was so informal that he sometimes received guests in bare feet, and he liked to do things for himself.
One of the first things he would do, he'd get up and go out and try to find a newsboy to buy a newspaper for himself. And it's hard for us to imagine in this day and age when you have hundreds of people working in the White House that his whole White House staff consisted of two young men in their 20s.
I'm almost laughing, Pat. I can't even imagine that. Talk about that, though.
Yeah, Lincoln had a lot of irons in the fire, didn't he? He was there in a very bare bones White House and had to do a lot of things on his own. That is fascinating, by the way. And then a whole other study, Lee, you can do some other time, is the relationship between Mr. Lincoln and Mrs. Lincoln. That's a whole other discussion. But I'm saluting Mr. Lincoln today. He died young. Those stories and questions will always be asked, Lee. What would have happened had he lived? How would our country be different? How would the world be different had he lived on, you know, another 20 years or so?
Yep.
We'll never know. But in the meantime, we've got a marvelous role model in Abraham Lincoln to look to and learn from and study in this whole intriguing area of leadership.
You know, I was listening to Daniel Day-Lewis, who, of course, had played Lincoln in the movie that Steven Spielberg directed. And he had talked about looking at the life of Lincoln and the toll leadership took on him physically and possibly even mentally. Talk about leadership under tough times, Pat, because it's got to be a lonely business and a tough business.
Yeah, well, there's no question, Lee. It's lonely at the top, and I don't think Lincoln had a whole lot of people he could turn to, you know, and really spend time with and really seek counsel. Or mentors, I guess we would call them.
Mm-hmm.
But in leadership, Lee, it's vital that we have people around us to keep us straight. Call them mentors, call them life coaches, call them sages if you wish. But every leader in any field needs to have those people around him or her so that they can be directed in the right way and learn and study from people who have one vital quality. It's called wisdom, Lee. Wisdom. It's such an important quality. And when you find people who have wisdom, it's important to keep them close to you.
Well, Pat, I wanted to end with you listening to your own words, if you don't mind, because it's such a great scene that you set with this writing. There's a beautiful quote at the end of your chapter on Lincoln about who he served above all. And inspired all of this service that we've heard about, Lincoln said it after a former slave bowed down to him in 1865. And this is what you wrote, Pat. You wrote, quote, "Don't kneel to me," said Lincoln. "That is not right. You must kneel to God only and thank him for the liberty you will hereafter enjoy. I am but God's humble instrument." And he believed that, Pat. And thank you so much for the continued effort to help us understand some of our great leaders, Pat, and all the great work you've done over the years writing about these men and women. Thanks so much, Pat, for everything.
Lee, thank you. Good to talk to you.
Same here. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And that says it all there at the end. And yes, it is lonely. And that's why so many men, that connection to God, that's the sounding board they've got left. That's it. And you heard it right there in Lincoln's words. And I think that's the core of the man right there. An African American kneeling down in thanks and him saying, "No, no, no, son. That's not right." This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. The life of Abraham Lincoln. More after this. Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and that's Steve Martin performing King Tut on Saturday Night Live. An actor, a writer, a producer, a musician, Steve Martin came to public notice in the 60s as a writer for the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and later as a frequent guest on The Tonight Show. In the 70s, he performed his odd and offbeat and quirky comedy routines before packed national houses. He's returned to doing stand-up and also regularly tours with his bluegrass band, the Steep Canyon Rangers. We start this segment with Steve's classic stand-up comedy album called Let's Get Small. Recorded in San Francisco at a boarding house in 77, the album went platinum and peaked at number 10 on the Billboard pop charts. This album won the Grammy in 1979 for Best Comedy Album. In this clip, Steve gives hilarious takes on smoking.
Well, not too many people smoking out here tonight. That's pretty good. Kind of bothers some people. If you're in a sleazy place like this and people start smoking, you know. It doesn't bother me in a nightclub because I'm used to it. If I'm in a restaurant though, and I'm eating and someone says, "Hey, mind if I smoke?" Well, I say, "Oh no, do you mind if I fart?" It's one of my habits. Yeah, they got a special section for me on airplanes now. I quit once for a year, you know. But I gained a lot of weight. And, it's hard to quit. You know, after sex, I really have the urge to light one up, huh? See, I'm not a very tactful person. You ever start talking to someone and you forget what you're going to say and you're standing there going, gee, I was going to say something, I forgot what it was. And they always go, well, it must not have been very important, you wouldn't have forgot it. I would say, oh, I remember, I'm radioactive. Shake.
Okay, we're moving now, eh, folks? Yes, this is comedy.
All right. Well, I've decided I'm taking up smoking. My doctor told me I wasn't getting enough tar. Now, the fun part of smoking is deciding what brand to smoke. Now, Virginia Slims, that's a woman's cigarette, right? What do they have, like little breasts on them or something?
Here's another funny clip from that same album where Steve talks about how mad he is at his 102-year-old mother.
I'm so mad at my mother. I don't know. She's 102 years old. She called me up the other day. She wanted to borrow $10 for some food. I said, hey, I work for a living. So I loan her the money. I have one of my secretaries take it down. And yesterday she calls me up and says she can't pay me back for a while. I said, what is this? So I worked it out with her. I'm having her work on my transmission. And if she can't fix that, I'm having her move my barbells up to the attic.
Oh, and every once in a while in Our American Stories, we want to just dig into a comic's life. We're going to be doing this over and over again over the next few months. Born Standing Up, A Comic's Life is a memoir released by Martin back in 2007. It chronicles his early life, his days working for Disneyland and the Magic Shop, working at coffee shops and clubs as a comedy act, his relationships, his eventual fame, and the reason why he quit stand-up comedy at the height of his fame in 1981. In this clip, we hear a portion of this fascinating look into the mind of a comic genius, read by Martin himself from his own audiobook. It starts with Steve's nonconformist chant.
And now, let's repeat the nonconformist oath. I promise to be different. I promise to be unique.
I promise to be unique.
I promise not to repeat things other people say.
I did stand-up comedy for 18 years. 10 of those years were spent learning, 4 years were spent refining, and 4 were spent in wild success. My most persistent memory of stand-up is of my mouth being in the present and my mind being in the future. The mouth speaking the line, the body delivering the gesture, while the mind looks back, observing, analyzing, judging, worrying, and then deciding when and what to say next. Enjoyment while performing was rare. Enjoyment would have been an indulgent loss of focus that comedy cannot afford. After the shows, however, I experienced long hours of elation or misery, depending on how the show went, because doing comedy alone on stage is the ego's last stand. My decade is the 70s, with several years extending on either side. Though my general recall of the period is precise, my memory of specific shows is faint. I stood on stage, blinded by lights, looking into blackness, which made every place the same. Darkness is essential. If light is thrown on the audience, they don't laugh. I might as well have told them to sit still and be quiet. The audience necessarily remained a thing unseen, except for a few front rows, where one sourpuss could send me into panic and desperation. The comedian's slang for a successful show is, "I murdered them," which I'm sure came about because you finally realized that the audience is capable of murdering you. Stand-up is seldom performed in ideal circumstances. Comedy's enemy is distraction, and rarely do comedians get a pristine performing environment. I worried about the sound system, ambient noise, hecklers, drunks, lighting, sudden clangs, latecomers, and loud talkers, and not to mention the nagging concern, is this funny? Yet the seedier the circumstances, the funnier one can be. I suppose these worries keep the mind sharp and the senses active. I can remember instantly retiming a punchline to fit around the crash of a dropped glass of wine, or raising my voice to cover a patron's ill-timed sneeze, seemingly microseconds before the interruption happened. I was seeking comic originality, and fame fell on me as a byproduct. The course was more plodding than heroic. I did not strive valiantly against doubters, but took incremental steps studded with a few intuitive leaps. I was not naturally talented. I didn't sing, dance, or act, though working around that minor detail made me inventive. I was not self-destructive, though I almost destroyed myself. In the end, I turned away from stand-up with a tired swivel of my head and never looked back until now. A few years ago, I began researching and recalling the details of this crucial part of my professional life, which inevitably touches upon my personal life, and was reminded why I did stand-up and why I walked away.
Fascinating, and what a writer. And we want to end where we started, and let's go back to Steve Martin's comedy album, Let's Get Small, and hear his hilarious insight into how it's impossible to be depressed when listening to the sound of a banjo.
Not a happy sound, it was just... You just can't sing a depressing song when you're playing the banjo. You just can't go, "Oh, death and grief and sorrow and murder." When you're playing the banjo, everything's okay. "Hey, Steve, your house is burning down." I just thought the banjo was the one thing that could have saved Nixon, you know? He went on television right at the right time, went, "Hi, everything's great." I think it'd be great if you had been traveling around the country and got off the plane and said, "I'd like to talk about politics, but first a little Foggy Mountain Breakdown." Then I'd go to foreign countries and I'd get off the plane and people would go, "Hey, do Foggy Mountain." Yeah, the banjo's so happy. I think people who are out of work, instead of giving them money, we should give them a banjo. And then go home and, "Did you get a job today, dear?" "Nope." "Doesn't matter, though."
Oh, and we're cracking up here, and that's what we want to do. And we're going to be going back across the Pantheon. We're going to be bringing in Richard Pryor, Sid Caesar, Woody Allen's nightclub years. You want to hear a great stand-up, whatever you think of Woody personally, his movies, his Greenwich Village tapes, some of the funniest stuff you've ever heard. We've all got to laugh, and we got to enjoy ourselves. Steve Martin. And we're going to go out again where we started, with Steve Martin singing King Tut on Saturday Night Live. This is Our American Stories. Great job on this, Jesse.
Dancing by the Nile.
Enjoy the music.
The ladies love this style.
Boss, tuck, tuck.
Rockin' for a mile.
Rockin' tuck, tuck.
He ate a crocodile.
Ooh.
He gave his life for tourism.
Down the hallway to his doom. I stood up to say goodbye like all the rest. And I heard him tell the warden just before he reached my cell, let my guitar playing friend do my request. Let him sing me back home with a song I used to hear, and make my old memories come alive, and take me away and turn back the years and sing home before I die.
This is Lee Habib. You're listening to
I recall
what I think is Merle Haggard's best song, and it's my favorite, and it is a sad song. It's a beautiful song. And for the hour, we're going to celebrate Merle's life. And every year, we'll replay this on the day he was both born and died. Because he's one of those rare human beings who his life began and ended on the same day. And so to tell a story properly, we figured we'd let Merle tell it to you. And we love to do that on Our American Stories. No opinions here. I mean, you heard which my favorite song was, but that's not exactly an opinion. Let's talk about his early life. And let's have him tell you about his fascination with trains.
I lived in an oil community called Oildale, and there was a daily train that went into the oil fields, and it was a steam train back in those days. And I actually grew up every evening, you know, kind of looking forward to seeing that old train pull out of there with about 40 or 50 oil tankers back during the war, you know, and my dad worked for the Santa Fe Railroad. I was 9 when he passed away, but I think probably the first time I ever jumped on that old oil tanker was probably I was about 5 years old. My mother would have died if she'd known I'd been up there. We used to put pennies on the track, you know, and we'd hop that old train, ride a block or two, and jump off. So it was something we learned to do young. And we'd watch the brakemen and the trainmen do it, you know, and it wasn't really all that hard.
Very matter-of-fact about a pretty hard-scrabbled existence he had. A lot of the Okies had moved out to this part of California, the Bakersfield area. And a lot of people don't think of California as an oil state, but it still is. Drive up there, and there they are. The rigs are everywhere. And Merle, we're celebrating his life, the unique Bakersfield sound he created. Not really country, not really rock, not really anything but Merle Haggard. There's nothing else you can say, or classic country. He had a bad experience on a train in Oregon.
There's a lot of bad experiences. I got on a freight in Oregon one time, and it was leaving out of Eugene, and it went up into the Cascades and into a snowstorm, and I was traveling in the ice compartment, and it me and two other oboes was in there, and it got rather cold in that metal. I remember they stopped up in the mountains and then climbed up out of that ice compartment, and I'm shaking so bad that I dropped my suitcase off the top of the freight and I had to get off for a while to get her up my clothes.
And as you're going to learn as we go along, this rough style of mix of musics, that twangy Fender, the unique mix of steel, guitar sounds, new vocal harmony styles, a little bit of jazz thrown in there, believe it or not, almost country jazz, had a lot to do with this life and the trains and the being an outcast in a bit of a way. Not really. You couldn't put Okies living in California in a category, and they were outcasts. So why was he incorrigible as a child?
I was, to say the least, probably the most incorrigible child you could think of. I was already on the way to prison before I realized it, actually. I was really kind of a screw-up. And I really don't know why. I think it was mostly just out of boredom and lack of a father's attention, I think.
Lack of a father's attention, I think. I think he knew that, actually. And that father had died when he was young. And that can impact a boy and impact a man and change everything, and we talk about that a lot here on Our American Stories. But as we'll learn later, Merle Haggard will tell you he could not have been Merle Haggard if he didn't lose his father, if he had not gone to prison. He was 14 when he was put in his first juvie home.
The authorities put me in there for truancy, for not going to school. And they gave me 6 months in like a road camp situation, and I ran off from there and stole a car. So then the next time I went back, it was for something serious, and then I spent the next 7 years running off from places. I think I escaped 17 times.
That's pretty incorrigible. And how did he escape from these institutions?
There was different institutions and different methods. There was some of them were minimum security, some were maximum security, and some of them were kid joints, and some of them were adult jailhouses. And I just didn't stay nowhere. I was just... I think Willie Sutton was my idol. If you don't know, you know, at the time I was in the middle of becoming an outlaw and escaping from jail and escaping from places that they had me locked up in was part of the thing that I wanted to do.
And very matter of fact, straight as an arrow in his singing and his storytelling and even speaking about his own life. And when we come back, more, this unique life, this unique American life, Merle Haggard celebrated. More after these messages.
We don't burn our trap cards down on Main Street, 'cause we like living right and being free. We don't make a party out of loving, but we like holding hands and pitching woo. We don't like the hippies out in San Francisco do. And I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee, a place where even squares can have a ball. We still wave old glory down at the courthouse, and white lightning's still the biggest thrill of all.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And Merle Haggard is the life we're celebrating today. Born and died on the same day. And a countercultural figure to the counterculture. That's what was going on in that song, in that space, in his country. And later Merle would pull it back a little bit, saying, look, I had no animus towards pot smokers, and I had no problem with people disagreeing with the war. But when you start spitting on my soldiers, when you start dishonoring the entire country, well, you're going to get, as he said, on the fighting side of me. That's another one of his great songs. So he's in and out of institutions. He's lost his dad at an early age. One day, he saw the light.
No, no. What I was doing, I really kind of was crazy as a kid. And then all of a sudden, you know, and while I was in San Quentin, I just... I one day understood that, and I saw the light, and I just didn't want to do that no more. And I realized what a mess I'd made out of my life. And I got out of there and stayed out of there. Never to go back. And went and apologized to all the people I'd wronged and tried to pay back the people that I'd taken money from, borrowed money from, or whatever. And I think when I was 31 years old, I paid everybody back that I'd ever taken anything from, and including my mother.
Including his mother, who we're going to talk about a little bit later. He was also lucky that while in prison, he was actually talked out of going on a final escape.
I think that these friends of mine talked me out of going on that escape. I mean, they felt that I had talent, and they felt that I was just a ornery kid and could probably make something out of my life. And you know, believe it or not, in the penitentiary, just some pretty nice people. And very unfortunate people, and they love to let somebody, so to speak, get up on their shoulders. You know, they like to boost somebody over the wall if they can. If they can't make it themselves, they, I think, sincerely love to see someone else make it.
And then it was life after prison, and he had developed a talent for music in prison. He had developed a love of music. We're going to get into that in a bit. And him seeing Johnny Cash while he was in prison. But here's a clip of Merle talking about life after prison and getting into music.
When I came out of the penitentiary, I went to work for my brother digging ditches and wiring houses. He had an electrical company, Hag Electric. And he was paying me $80 a week. This was 1960. And I was working 8 hours a day there, and I got me a little gig playing guitar 4 nights a week for $10 a night. There was a little radio show that we had to broadcast from this little nightclub called High Pockets. It just all started from that. Some people that was local stars around heard me on this radio program and came down and offered me a better job in town, and it wasn't just a matter of weeks till I was part of the main clique in Bakersfield. And it was hard to get in that clique. There was a lot of people like Buck Owens, and there was people that were really good and proved how good they were later on with their success. And Bakersfield was some sort of a, I don't know, it was like country music artists found their way to Bakersfield and had the success out of there. I don't understand why, actually. It may be because of the migration that took place in the 30s or whatever. There was a lot of people that came out there from Oklahoma and Arkansas and Texas that had a lot of soul. And this thing we call country music kind of came out of those honky-tonks, you know, and some of the same area that a lot of other things came out of.
Yeah, he was right about that mix and that time and that place. And it's happened in American music many times. You had Seattle and the grunge movement. Look at New Orleans and the ascent of jazz, blues, Chicago, and the connection between the Mississippi Delta and these folks just going straight up 55 to Chicago. And the next thing you know, this city is the blues city. In New York, you could look at the heyday of jazz in the 50s, where Miles Davis and John Coltrane are occupying maybe 5 to 6 square blocks of city space with the Vanguard and these spots where legendary jazz musicians descended, and so on and so forth. So how does he adjust from prison to success?
You know, a lot of people may or may not understand how hard it is for a person coming out of an institution, you know, whether it be a prison or whether it be a some sort of a mental institution, whether it be the Army or whatever. There's a thing that happens, like when you leave the penitentiary, when you've been there for 3 years, you have friends and you have a way of life and you have a routine, and a whole way of life that you just give up all of a sudden. One day you're there, and you're next day you're not there, and you don't have any more friends from the outside because things went on when you left, and you can't find anybody there, and the people you left behind in prison are really your only friends. And there's a period of adjustment that took me about 120 days, I don't know, about 4 months. A couple of times I really wanted to go back. And it's really a weird sensation. It's the loneliest feeling in the world about the second night out of the penitentiary.
And this is what makes Merrill special in the end, is just forthrightness about things that many people wouldn't admit. I think it's why we love Shawshank Redemption. Even if we've not been in prison, we've been in that place where we know something really well, and then we've got to go somewhere else. We're dislocated. I had immigrant parents. They always reminded me of what it was like to leave a place like Lebanon and come here. They said it was the loneliest year of their life, and they wanted to go back, and they were scared, and they were nervous. And that's why when we see Red hanging himself in Shawshank, you can watch that once a week and still cry, because there's a little part of you in that guy, and if there's not, there's something wrong with you. And so this is, again, what made Merle. Let's hear from himself about why he thought he was such a special writer.
I'm pretty ordinary, and the music is about ordinary people.
And that's what made him special. And he believed it, and he lived it. And my goodness, he wrote about it. When did he know music might be something he was good at?
I think I must have been at least 12 or 13 years old, probably, before I realized that I might have something that everybody didn't have. And I had a good ear, and that violin teacher, when I was very young, remarked about my ear, and I remembered that. I knew I had a good ear. Being without a great education, I knew that I needed a little help from somewhere, and music was the thing for me. I knew it was powerful.
Again, we hear that over and over again, that word of a teacher, that word of one person. Remember, we did that Jerry Kramer clip where Coach Lombardi sits down, and I know you can be the best offensive lineman in the history of the NFL. And you hear Jerry Kramer 30 years later remembering it like he was a young man, and how that powered him and fueled him. And just remember, your words matter, as Pat Williams always tells us. And that word of encouragement to somebody, it lasts a lifetime. And so what song catapulted his career? It was Sing Me a Sad Song, and here's Merle on how he got his hands on that song.
I was working in a nightclub in Las Vegas, and Wynn Stewart was the band leader, and he had that song. He wrote it. And he'd had about 8 or 9 country hits in a row, and he was fixing to record that again. And I cornered him one night, and I said, "Hey," I said, "Wynn," I said, "would you, if you had a chance, and it was within your power, would you make me a star?" And he said, "Well, of course I would, you know." I said, "I think it might be within your power." I said, "If you'll let me have that song, Sing Me a Sad Song, I believe I can record a hit on it." Well, I did, and it went to number 19 in the Billboard charts.
And here's that song. And again, the generosity of a man he knew catapulted his career.
Sadness and singing as blue as I feel. If a tear should appear, it's because she's not here. Sing a sad song and sing it for me.
This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More on Merle Haggard after these messages.
She told me so. I'm unhappy without her, and I still love her. made a song, a sadness, pretend it's the end of the world. Sing it sweet and sing it low, and then I'll have to go. Sing a sad song and sing it for me.
And that's Merle Haggard, a distinctive voice, straight as an arrow, simple writing, a legend. And we were just talking about his life in prison, the special talent he knew he had that God had gifted him, and a violin teacher had pulled it out of him and reinforced it. There was another person who had a big impact on Merle's life, Johnny Cash.
Well, when I was doing the little stand away from home, Johnny Cash came to the San Quentin and played there on New Year's Day, 1958. And some years later, skip forward, I was doing his television show. And he was talking about his performance at San Quentin in 1958. He said, I remember I wasn't even able to sing. And he said, I got a good response. I said, I remember that too. He said, what do you mean you remember? You weren't in my band. I said, no, but I was in the audience.
No, but I was in the audience. And here's Merle talking about a song that he loved, The Fugitive.
Well, I was playing in Sacramento one night, and I'd had a couple of hit records would say that went into the top five. But I hadn't had a number one record yet, and played in Sacramento, and this lady came to the show, and she had these songs, and she wanted us to go out and let us hear these songs and cook breakfast for us, and I didn't want to go. And my brother talked me into it. Got out there, and she sang me about five number one songs, and The Fugitive was one of them, and her name was Liz Anderson. And her husband, Casey Anderson. They were songwriters. And so she was responsible for giving me my first number one song.
Down every road, there's always one more city. I'm on the run, the highway. My home. I raised a lot of cane back in my younger days. While Mama used to pray my crops would fail. Now I'm a hunted fugitive with just two ways. Outrun the law or spend my life in jail. I'd like to settle down, but they won't let me. A fugitive must be a rolling stone. Down every road, there's always one more city. Highway is my home. I'm lonely, but I can't afford the luxury of having I love to come along. She don't slow me down, and they'd catch up with me. or he who travels fastest goes alone. I'd like to settle down, but they won't let me. A fugitive must be a rolling stone. Down every road there's always one more city. I'm on the run, the highway is my home. I'm on the run, the highway is my home.
And I love that Merle credits the writers, Liz and Casey Anderson. Just as Sinatra credited the writers, the orchestrators. Without these songs, Merle wouldn't have been Merle. You know, I had a friend of mine who was a traveling salesman, and he never went to prison. He never had a rough and rugged life, but this was his favorite song, and he always told me it was a lyric, "He who travels fastest goes alone." And he had a dynamic tension in his life. He wanted to be a multimillionaire, and he wanted to have a family. And the millionaire part won out, and he lost his family. And I think the appeal of Merle's writing is that it's not just literal, that you can understand and relate to just the very straightforward nature of how he wrote about loss, conflict, and love. Here's Merle on storytelling and songwriting.
It's a combination of things that I look for. I want to say something in a way that it hasn't been said, maybe, but still has a profound statement. You know, we want to say I love you in a different way. And I don't believe there's any subject that can be a love song. You know, if I could choose any subject that I could write about, I'd want it to be about love, because that's really what we want to write about, I think. Most current-day writers, I think, are trying to say I love you.
Yeah, I think that's what we're all writing about in some way, shape, or form if we write. What kind of impact did his success have on him as a person?
I don't know. I can't separate the personality from, you know, I am what I am. I do what I do, and that's it. I go out to the bus, and I'm just dad and grandpa and darling, you know, to my family, and they accept the fact that this is what I do, and I probably won't touch the guitar again or play again until we go out middle of next month. Me and Willie have a tour set in the East. And I used to play at home all the time, but I don't play anymore. And so the family, I'm just another old retired gray-haired gentleman hanging around the house.
And how did darkness impact his writing?
I look for those moments. I live for the moments that are spine tinglers, raise the hair on the back of your neck, little things that occur, somebody says at the right moment, that explains a lot of things, you know, and you look for those things to write about. I hope the door is always open when something goes by, and I hope I'm aware of it, able to catch it and write about it. But that's an effort. Most of the songs that I've written that have been successful, you might say, were given to me. I mean, I can't really remember sweating them out. You know, they kind of handed to me.
And when we come back, we're going to hear about how one of the songs, Mama Tried, was handed to him. And we're going to talk about his mama before we talk about the song. Merle Haggard's Life, Our American Stories. More after this.
Not feeling any pain at closing time. But tonight your memory found me. couldn't drink enough to keep you off my mind. Tonight the bottle let me down.
I'm from a poor family, and when you lose half of the house, my father died when I was 9, so my mother was left with the entire operation, which wasn't much, but I don't know how it could be any further down than I was. I mean, we were, we didn't have no sidewalks, we didn't have no clock tower.
And that's Merle Haggard. And this is the thing about America. Coming from almost any circumstance, you can end up almost any place. And Merle always had a sympathy and an ear for ordinary folks and for people left behind. Because he knows, but for the grace of God go I, it could have been, well, his life could have turned in 100 different directions. And a lot of them not good. And even in prison, he had help from prisoners who stopped him from making this final escape when he was at a prison where if he made an escape from that prison, it could have had dire consequences. So let's talk about those songs that he said were handed to him. What does that mean, having a song handed to someone? Here he is talking about another hit of his, Mama Tried.
I don't remember writing it, but I did. I wrote it, and it says things that are kind of silly and kind of profound, but yet they match feelings all over the world. People tattoo it on the side of their neck. Mama tried. I think a lot of people feel like their mother wasn't able to do all she wanted to, you know.
First thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind but Mama tried. The one and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my mama seemed to know what lay in store. Despite all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, till Mama couldn't hold me anymore. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried. Dear old daddy, rest his soul, left my mom a heavy load. She tried so very hard to fill his shoes. Working hours without rest, wanted me to have the best. She tried to raise me right, but I refused. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried.
And what lyrics? Despite all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, so Mama couldn't hold me anymore. And by the way, he puts all the blame square on himself, and it's not a lament. It's just a description, and it's why the song is so powerful still, and it's just a perfect story, and it's so economical, and it's so tight, And it's so simple. And try doing that. I dare you to try and write a song like that. You'll spend your whole life and never come close. Here's Merle talking about his mom.
I can't imagine what she went through. Now, I've got six children of my own. It's not just a phrase. I really can't imagine what she went through. It must have been awful.
Must have been awful. And you had to see his face during this interview. And by the way, we're getting a lot of this sound from Dan Rather's really superb work here. And he's done a bunch of interviews with artists that are as good can be. And so why do you keep touring and playing, Merle?
Well, I'm scared of the loneliness. It'll get awful quiet, awful quick. If you want to be left alone, they'll leave you alone. People leave you alone. But you don't want that, and I don't want it either. I mean, we want to be what we have been all of our life, and we want to continue, and we don't want to ever die. And you know that's the next big event once you retire.
It is the next big event, and it came. And we're celebrating the life of Merle Haggard, born and died on the same day, in his own words, as we like to do as often as possible here on Our American Stories, bring you these lives directly from the people who live them. Here's Merle on a subject I think we all know, loneliness.
Loneliness is a terrible thing. And you know, the older you get, the fewer people you know. I mean, you think about somebody 90 years old, they don't know anybody that's older than them. You know, and it's got to be a much better life if you're Merle Haggard with a big fan base trying to play and try to keep your craft up to standards. And I think that keeps you alive.
Well, it does for him. And he said, think about it. Someone who's 90 years old doesn't know many people who are older than them. And it's true. And by the way, I love hearing the talk about millennials, and I'm hoping lots of millennials are listening. But my goodness, sit down and talk to a 90-year-old and sit down and talk to a 20-year-old. Who's more interesting? And it doesn't mean 20-year-olds aren't interesting. But too often in life, we push the 90-year-olds out. And here on this show, we're going to hear from old people and young people and every kind of person. And listening to Merle's raw emotion here is something. Here's Merle on the song Send Me Back Home and why he thinks it's one of his best songs.
Send Me Back Home is one of my best songs, there's no doubt about it. And I think that even people that have never been to jail know somebody that's been to jail. They have an imagination of what it might be like. Someone can arrest you for something you didn't do and you go to prison. If you weren't Dan Rather, you wouldn't get out. There's people in all over this nation doing time that didn't do anything. I think that would be a terrible thing.
And that ended that interview with Dan Rather. And if you want to hear that in its entirety, and I think it's important to see it, to see the expressions in Merle's face, it's something. And just Google Dan Rather and Merle Haggard, and it'll pop right up to the top, and hopefully we can really push a lot more views to that. And there was a great piece written in the Wall Street Journal by Eddie Dean called The Right Inside of Merle Haggard. I wanted to hit just a piece of it, and then we're going to go out with the song we started this hour with, and the song that Merle thought was his best, and I think it is too. In Footlights, the dour downer of an opening song on his 1979 album, Serving 190 Proof, Merle Haggard sings about having to perform on stage when the inspiration's gone. He was 41 and he looked like he was drinking plenty of hard stuff after his run of country hits had dried up. But the song is more than a lament about midlife crises and the grind of the road. It's about a crisis of faith. For Haggard, who died Wednesday at age 79, music was a sacred calling. Now he had to face the fact that it had just become a job. The muse had left the building. He later explained the song's origins. Minutes before a concert, Haggard was told that his boyhood idol, honky-tonk singer Lefty Frizzell, had died. He played the show and felt like a sellout to show business fakery. As he later put it in that song, quote, "Tonight I'll kick the footlights out, and I'll try to hide the mood I'm really in." This sort of candor was, and still is, rank blasphemy in country music, a business where bloodshot eyes aren't allowed on camera, and a big smile at meet and greets with fans can often be as important as talent. It was this brand of to hell with them honesty that set Merle Haggard apart from the herd for his entire career. He was a child of the Depression. He was unafraid to write and sing about the Depression and about all other things. Loneliness, love, loss, and death. Subjects usually swept under the rug in country music. And also subjects like prisoners and personal failure and alcoholism and racism. Merle Haggard's life. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories.
Sing me back home before I die. Sing me back home before I die.